Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing lawyers for global challenges.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Remember the summer of 2008. Gas prices over $4 a gallon. SUVs parked. That's nothing, says Christopher Steiner. Try $8 a gallon, or $12, or $20. The world and lives, yours, would change big time. Critics say it will never happen. Chris Steiner says, what if this hour on Point, the road to $20 a gallon gas, heaven, hell, or never going to happen, you decide. Joining me now from Chicago is Christopher Steiner, staff writer for Forbes magazine, a trained civil engineer. He's author of $20 per Gallon, How the Inevitable Rise in the Price of Gasoline Will Change Our Lives for the Better. Chris Steiner, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
You call it a thought exercise. It's pretty fun. We're going to test the thesis before we're finished here, but you go chapter by chapter. You start at $4 a gallon. We were there in 2008, and take us to 6 and 8 and 10 and 12 and right on up to 20. We'll come and look at the details and get inside how you figured it, but give us some of the headlines from each of those dollar points. Chris, what happens at 6? What happens at 8? Give us the headline.
Well, I think, you know, at $6 we see a lot of extensions of what started to happen last summer. And a lot of things started to percolate, and of course, none of them had a chance to sustain themselves just because we went down so quickly as far as the price of gas due to the economic collapse the world saw. But there's a lot of smaller themes within that, a lot of surprising things that happened affecting America's obesity rate, the air quality in America, health care costs, all sorts of things that are tied to the price of gas. But beyond that, there's
things that did happen at $4 or would happen at $6, Chris?
Things that would have happened at $4 had it been a sustained price. And, those effects will be exacerbated at $6.
So give us a sense. At $6, look out across the country. What do you see happening to health, to transportation, you name it? What begins to bite at $6?
Well, just starting off with the number of people who die on the roads of America. Right now we lose about 45,000 people a year to car crashes. But as we saw at $4, those numbers really started to go down, the rate at which we lost people on the roads. Because when the price of gas is higher, people drive less, they drive slower, and they drive less frivolously. There's a professor at Harvard, David Grabowski, who says that $6 gas would actually save us 16,000 lives that we lose now to car crashes.
So there's just safety on the roads. In 08, you remind us, when gas was high, Americans drove 100 billion fewer miles than they did the year before. At $6, presumably that goes up further. So people are not getting run over, and maybe, what, they're slimmer because they're walking more?
They are. I mean, a lot of people have an option to take public transit or some sort of bike or walking to get to work, but they don't because it's easier to drive, and right now it doesn't affect their pocketbook too adversely. If we got the $5 or $6, I think you'd see a lot of people carpooling, walking to the train, moving to places where their families can walk. And I think in that sense, you'll see if we saw gas prices sustained at those types of levels, you'd see development of walkable communities because people would demand that, and developers typically build what people want. And over the last 20 years, people have wanted big houses further and further away from work centers and central cities.
At $4, the SUV was in trouble. At $6, you say it's dead. At $8, your chapter title is "The Skies Will Empty." Commercial air travel finished at $8 a gallon?
Well, I wouldn't say it's finished, no. But I do think the way that we jump on a plane now for a lot of us is like getting in a cab. A lot of us go from New York to San Francisco without thinking about it. It's $250 or $300. I think in the future that plane ticket's going to be closer to $1,000.
$1,000, and so what? People just don't jet off to that Colorado cabin or maybe to that timeshare in the Caribbean or whatever it is.
Well, I think people with houses in Aspen are going to continue to do whatever they want to do. But for most of us, I think, the plane trip across the country might be a once-a-year thing instead of a 3 or 4 times a year thing.
At $10 a gallon, you say Disney World will close.
I think certainly prolonged higher gas prices would do Disney World in just because they rely on air traffic to bring in the bulk of their customers. They can't survive on day trippers from Orlando. And the same goes for half of the Las Vegas Strip. I think Las Vegas will survive, but I don't think the current volume that exists in the hotel world there, I think you have 19 of the 25 largest hotels in the world are in Las Vegas. That won't be sustainable when you can't have so many people coming in on the airlines every day into that airport.
You see the Las Vegas sort of tourism profile, hotel profile, whacked down by half. At $12, those suburbs you were describing, Chris, you said aren't just unpopular, they're really unaffordable at $12 a gallon gas. I mean, it's hard to even picture. Who knows if it'll ever get there? But at that, if it did, you say they would literally begin to empty out the suburbs, that, especially distant ones that surround our cities.
Yes, and I think some of those effects will come well before $12. I mean, there's a certain linear progression we had to obey when we wrote the book, but I do think a lot of these effects certainly, they're going to take place before $12 a gallon gas. I think that's kind of a point of no return for a lot of these suburbs. And there is hope for a lot of these places. I think the ones that are able to add some kind of sense of economic gravity to what right now might be just a bedroom community, I think those places will do well. I think in a lot of urban planners and leaders in some of these places realize that already, and they're trying to bring some center of density, some center of job creation to their communities that right now don't have anything like that.
At $14 a gallon for gas, and this is getting beyond where it's easy to imagine, way beyond, but at that point, you say Walmarts would close down because they couldn't afford to truck around the products to stock their shelves. At $16 a gallon, our entire web of food distribution history.
Right. You have all these bizarre things that go on in the food world right now. For instance, in Chicago, when I walk into a grocery store, I typically see, and this is all year round, I see apples from New Zealand, I see apples from Japan, Washington State. What I don't see are apples from southwest Michigan or southeast Wisconsin, even though those orchards are much closer to my house, and there's a ton of orchards there. I have to typically go to those farms to buy the apples myself. In the future, in Chicago, I won't be seeing apples from New Zealand.
You know, and then you take it right on up to 20, and we're looking at kind of, it's almost in some way as science fiction. In other ways, you've got some very familiar and very old-fashioned ways of life. You're quite positive about this arc that I think a lot of people would find very painful. James Howard Kunstler wrote last summer a long piece in the Rolling Stone called The Long Emergency. You paint a pretty bright picture of what this march upward of energy prices might mean. He painted a pretty dark kind of dystopian picture. What takes you to the bright side of this arc, Chris?
Well, certainly I'm on the opposite side of the arc as James Howard Kunstler is. He kind of imagines a world where he says oil is going to pretty much disappear for most of us within the next 10 years, and it's going to be apocalyptical. Build a bunker and get some guns is kind of the way he sees things. I think there's still a lot of oil left in the ground. I do think supply will slowly ebb as the decades wear on here, and demand is going to keep on burgeoning across the globe, and that's going to force prices up. But I think people will be very surprised at how well we adapt to a world of lesser oil, a scarcer oil. And I think people kind of forget how well we've adapted always. We didn't have the kind of oil largesse that we have now, 120 years ago. Now that we, 120 years ago, we didn't have the type of oil that we have now, but we still had bustling cities. Technology was moving ahead. I think we'll still use oil in all sorts of capacities in the future. We'll just use less of it to do some of the same things. But, yeah, some paradigms will fall.
So if it's not dystopia, if it's not blood in the streets and chaos and kind of the Kunstler right. view, what's your view? Paint a little picture of this $20 a gallon world. Is it back to 1890? Is it back before Rockefeller began to really, ship the oil? Are we riding horses to the job?
I don't think we're riding horses to the job. I do think technology is going to play a large role in our futures. I think it's going to keep all of us binded through the World Wide Web. And when you talk about, say, a person living in a small town in downstate Illinois, they could work for a company in Chicago or New York or D.C., and certainly you couldn't do that in Rockefeller's time. I think people are going to live more walkable lives. I think we'll own fewer cars, we'll drive fewer miles, and we'll typically eat food that doesn't come from so far away.
So it's going to be the kind of homespun life, garden in the backyard, a wool sweater from the neighbor's farm, ma and pa kettle?
Well, I think you'll still see globalization. It's not going to totally go away, but certainly for the low-value-added goods, just plastic doodads and whatnot, I don't think that's going to be a feasible thing in the future. But high-value-added items like iPods, things that cost more than $100 and are quite small. I think those, you'll still see those types of things moving around the globe. We'll still have them. But, you know, will you have to buy a sweater from your neighbor? I don't think so.
And then there's the really big question of whether we're really ever going to get anywhere near here. I mean, I've seen calculations saying that $20 a gallon gas would mean $800 a barrel oil. We're at something like 70 now. We were 140, 50 in 08. But, I mean, surely before we get to $800 a barrel oil, there are a lot of alternative energies that might come online that would take that would change the storyline.
Absolutely. I think $20 a gallon gas at worst or at best, however you want to look at it, is several decades in the future. And it may never happen because we may mitigate our use of oil enough to a point where oil doesn't play a role, the same type of role it does in our lives right now. I think the point is that we do have to make a lot of these changes in the book. Whether that change happens at $16 a gallon or $10 a gallon or $12 a gallon, I think is a side conversation.
Get a critical view in the moment. We've got a lot of response, Chris Steiner, from our listeners already. I mean, the Financial Times reads your book and says, you know, calls it a thought-provoking introduction to one of the most important forces shaping the 21st century. Highly recommended. Christine writes on the web. She says, bring it, along with more bikes, public transportation, and telecommuting. We'll look at that. But here's a Twitter from Jason in Iowa and says, your book, your theme, sounds like a great argument for drill here, drill now. What do you say, Chris?
Well, I have no problem with people who want to keep drilling. The problem is I don't think it's going to answer much. We find one barrel of oil for every four we use in the world right now. And as far as the United States reserves go, I mean, we made this giant discovery last 2 weeks ago, if you recall. BP found a new giant field in the Gulf of Mexico, which holds 3 billion barrels of oil. Well, about 1 billion of that will be recoverable.
This is 6 miles below the surface of the Gulf, way, way, way down there. But 3 billion sounds like a big number. Even a billion sounds like a big number.
Well, it's a billion, but that's less than 2 months worth of supply for the United States of America.
One gulp.
Yeah, one gulp.
So drill here, drill now doesn't matter. What are you, a nuclear guy or just a pedal power?
I think nuclear has to play a much larger role in our future energy plans. And I think at some point the federal administration, whoever's in place here, hopefully this happens with the Obama administration, they put forth some kind of federal energy plan, which we really don't have. There are states that have said we need to get this much from here, this much from there. But federally, we really haven't done that. And I think the first step for us to bring on more nuclear power, more alternative power, is to get the feds behind some kind of plan.
And maybe it'll be there, maybe it won't. Amory Lovins, no small environmentalist and alternative energy guy himself, writes recently, Chris Steiner, that oil's customers will go away before oil does. He looks back to whaling, and whale oil lit up most houses in the mid-19th century. Whales got shy and scarce, he writes. Price of whale oil went up. Competitors came, chiefly synthetic oil, gas from coal. And the whalers ran out of customers before they ran out of whales. He says oil feels like this today, that they did a study at his operation out there in Colorado and found that technologies would replace all U.S. oil use at an average of $15 a barrel. That would put gas nowhere near 20.
Well, I think Amory Lovins has a very good outlook on the future. I don't tend to agree with him as far as the metrics of his prices go, because he says we can afford to make these changes at $15 a barrel of oil. Well, we're way past 15. Where are the changes? And we got to 150, and a lot of things he talks about never happened. And as far as whale oil goes, well, whale oil, yes, we did hunt out a lot of the whales, but also we started finding oil in the ground that was a lot easier to get to and a lot easier to use. So until we find another source of oil in the ground, I think oil is going to continue to play a giant role in our economy.
Let's hear from our listeners. Alexander in Gloucester, Massachusetts. Alexander, you're on the air.
Hi. For the time that I spent in Asheville, North Carolina, I wanted to relate this little anecdote. There was a ritual that happened with the teenagers and youngsters to bring out their cars along what was called Patton Avenue, mm-hmm. and just roll their hot rods around in an endless circle, showing off how much they had spent on their vehicles.
Time-honored American tradition since American graffiti and before.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, and around here you can go down to the Revere Strip and see the same kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But in the immediate aftermath of Katrina, as soon as the gas prices jumped beyond $3, that whole thing just stopped. And it had been going on for years, and it was like everyone avoided that part of town because they knew there was going to be a traffic jam on Friday night because the kids were out on Patton Avenue.
So if it went to $5 a gallon or $6 a gallon, then what? Then what?
Exactly. When I think of the premise of this, I love it because it's so practical. I, myself, have been without a car for a year now. I bicycle and take public transportation everywhere I go. I've lost about 30 pounds just not by even trying. And I feel better, I look better, and I have a better outlook. So I don't think that being without gas and having this higher price is even a problem. I once heard someone say, I don't know who it was, that we're running on a tank with no gauge. That's how the American oil supply is we don't really know when it's going to just dry up and go. I envisioned a time when perhaps the only people who could afford to use petroleum products for any kind of transportation usage would be the government.
Alexander, in Gloucester, you've got a keen view of it and 30 pounds off to show for it. Thanks for your call. Let me get one more right here from Nashville. Mac, you're on the air.
Yes, I also biked to work for many years. The problem has been and continues to be that I live just on the edge of suburbia,
mm-hmm.
and the infrastructure is really not there for me to commute by bike anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So when do we think there's going to be enough of a cataclysmic event or some sort of tipping point that forces the infrastructure to be able to make some of these lifestyle changes?
Great question.
Chris
Steiner, what do you say? Where is the big tipping point? Is it gradual? How do you envision your sort of benevolent view of this evolution?
Well, I think there's the book's really about a series of tipping points, but I think $6 a gallon gas is a giant tipping point for America. Clearly, $4 affected us in ways that had never happened before. We got the $2, we got the $3. Americans really didn't change their behaviors. We got the $4, and everything changed. I think everyone remembers what happened last summer when we got the $4. People were being almost downright irrational when it came to how much they drove and what car they drove at that time. People were selling their SUVs for cents on the dollar and paying way too much money for Toyota Priuses. But I do think $6 a gallon is going to convince Americans that life won't be the same, that we do have to make changes. And that may lead to things that help us avert prices of, say, over $12 or $15 a barrel a gallon if we're able to bring on a lot of these changes earlier, say at $6 per gallon. And I think that places like Nashville most of our cities have a long way to go as far as integrating some of these outer suburbs with easier and less energy-intense ways to get to the job centers. But that said, a lot of these places have highways and roads that offer us some kind of corridor to build either light rail, dedicated bus lanes, or a bike trail in those places.
Here's a web post from across the Atlantic. Joel writes, "We already pay more than $7 a gallon over here in Europe, and people can still lead normal lives. Now we drive Audi A4 TDIs, not V8-powered Crown Victorias, but life is good nevertheless." A little taste of future from the other side of the pond. Chris Steiner, please stand by in Chicago. Joining us right now from Baldhead Island, North Carolina, is Mark Mills. He is author with Peter Huber of The Bottomless Well, The Twilight of Fuel, The Virtue of Waste, and Why We Will Never Run Out of Energy. Mark Mills, thanks very much for joining us.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for having me, and hello, Chris.
Chris writes in Forbes, you had an essay in Forbes recently saying don't bet on $800 a barrel oil, the kind of price that might produce $20 a gallon gas. You've got some counterarguments for Chris. Let's hear them, Mark.
Well, Chris and I agree on a number of things, and it's a great read, Chris, and congratulations. Where the fundamental disagreement would be is just in two areas. The long before oil gets even close to those kinds of prices, the amount of synthetic oils or even conventional oils could be created and found is staggering. In a sense, the view that we're going to get prices soar past $4 and stay there is a pessimistic view of technology as opposed to a optimistic view of technology. The amount of oil that's what we'll call conventional mm-hmm. that's available in tar sands and coal conversion that will become economically feasible at, let's say, a permanent price of $4 or $5 a gallon is staggering. And that doesn't even count the kinds of genetic engineering that's possible and conceivable. The other piece here, just as a point of reference, a lot of our discussion has been focused, it sounds to me like, on how consumers will behave with respect to their automobile.
Mm-hmm.
Far more important is how the marketplace, the industrial manufacturing marketplace, or the heart of our economy, what it will react to and high-priced energy. High-priced energy would impact uniformly across the economy. If prices go up, jobs will get more scarce. Industries will become stressed. And I don't listen. My view would be I don't think that any government that's in a free world will tolerate sustained high prices, and they will unleash innovation and incentives to let businesses and technology generate vast quantities of liquid hydrocarbons.
Well, let's start with just those two. Chris Steiner, you get to $4 a gallon for gas, and you hear Mark Mills says you're going to have a lot of options. Technology will go to work. And it would have to, because the industrial impact of higher energy prices would be unbearable. What do you say, Chris?
Well, I think the emailer from Europe makes a good point here. They pay, in a lot of cases, almost $10 per gallon, and you don't see the type of synthetic fuel making going on. I think the only time we've seen that sustained in the world is, of course, during World War II, and wartime's not a very good example. I think in a point that Mark makes in his book and a lot of other things he writes, I think it's a very good point. Most of the energy we use is, in fact, to refine energy. And to make all these synthetic forms of energy, be it biofuels or from coal or tar sands, we need a lot of energy to do that. You know, when you talk about, say, 200 billion barrels of reserves being in Alberta, that number, it might be right, but it also is going to take 400 trillion cubic feet of natural gas to get that crude oil out of those tar sands.
No, fair point, Chris. The vast quantities of energy are needed to refine crude energy into the kinds of energy we like, whether it's electricity or gasoline in a car. But let me just jump back to a point on our friend in Europe or
mm-hmm.
Finland, where gasoline is $7 or $10 a gallon. The world does just fine over there in small countries and when the consumers are paying that. But keep in mind, the oil producers are not getting that price. That's all tax-based. The unleashing mm-hmm. of new production at $10 a gallon, which is $400 a barrel, will occur when the producers get the $400 a barrel. Right now, the governments are getting that money, not the oil producers. You want to unleash a flood of more oil production, you have a sustained price, even a fraction of that, in the world oil markets, and you'll see a gusher of oil production and natural gas, by the way, which is essentially fully fungible with oil for all practical purposes.
Chris Steiner, when it comes to coal, I read you recently calling coal the dark enemy here. Mark points to it, though, as you know, potentially something we'll have to turn to. What do you say, Chris?
Well, I think that if you take global warming seriously, and some people don't, and there's arguments for both sides, I think coal just isn't something we really want to dig any further into. And when you talk about our energy secretary here in the United States, Secretary Chu, he calls coal his worst nightmare, and I tend to agree.
He did reverse that position, Chris, publicly after saying that, as you probably know, because half of America's electricity comes from coal, and it's not exactly a politically comfortable position. Listen,
that's why it's a political thing, yeah.
Technologically, it is. There's no question at high prices that one can convert coal into oil without seriously impacting carbon emissions. It's a cost issue, not a technology issue. As soon as you move oil and coal prices into the stratosphere, the ability to convert billions and hundreds of billions of tons of coal and oil becomes feasible at tiny fractions of the prices we're talking
about. Without the global warming impact that many fear, Mark?
The challenge of not emitting carbon dioxide is a technical challenge, which is another way of saying it's an economic challenge. So once you decide that energy should be expensive, all kinds of things are possible. The chemistry of taking carbon dioxide out of things is a cost. If you want coal plants to emit nothing, they can be built. You can make zero-emission coal plants. There's a whole group that's formed around the zero-emission coal plant technology. It's technologically feasible. It's staggeringly expensive, but it is a fraction of the cost of oil at the prices that you're positing in your book.
Let's get a call from Evan in Richmond, Virginia. Evan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was just going to say that I think the previous caller was correct, too, in saying a self-respecting government is not going to allow the prices to get that high, just because in the United States especially, we don't really have the infrastructure to support people being able to take public transportation seriously or be able to bike to work, because they just don't live that close. And I feel like it's something that maybe should happen would be a very welcome change for the United States in the way that Europe is lined out. But I just don't think it's necessarily set up, especially when you consider previous oil crises that didn't produce these kinds of drastic changes that we're discussing today.
So you're saying it won't change because we couldn't handle the change, but just because we couldn't handle it, does that guarantee that it won't?
Well, I think that saying that the prices are going to go up because of a shortage, creating all of this drastic change is a little bit assumptive, because if you look at the previous oil crisis that we've had and that we faced before, I mean, all the people were lining up at the gas station for miles because of a shortage and because of the prices, but nothing necessarily changed.
Evan, thanks for your call. Chris Steiner, what do you say to The View?
Well, we haven't seen an oil crisis like we will see in the future. All the oil crisis Evan was talking about were embargoes that we knew there was an end coming. People were just holding back their oil. We have never gotten to a point where world demand has basically caught up with world supply, and that's where we exist right now, and that's with an economy that is rather stagnant. When you talk about 1 billion people in the world right now living American-style lives, and that number is going to go to 3 billion by 2040, that's 2 billion more people standing in line with us at the energy spigot. So we've never been here before. And so to compare it to oil crises of the 1980s or the 1970s isn't really fair. But I do think that Evan makes a good point. We don't have the infrastructure. But to say that our government's going to step in and fix this, I think the government at some point may even step in and go the opposite direction and raise the price of gas, similar to the way they do in Europe, certainly not as drastically, however.
Mark, I know I've just got you for another minute. You know, Chris posits a drastic run-up in energy prices, but he's rather sunny about it. You're not quite, you're not so alarmist, let's say, but how do you feel about how we'll handle the change? Do you see a bright transition here or something darker?
Well, Chris and I agree that we've never been here before. The world's population and appetite for comfort and safety, convenience, and affluence are unprecedented and unprecedented magnitude. The main difference between Chris and I is that I'm a technological optimist based on all of my work and research over the years, and I have no doubt that if governments get out of the way, basically, and do things to provide incentives for technological advancement, that we can more than easily meet the world's energy appetites, including for liquid hydrocarbons for transportation.
Get out of way. Many have said government needs to prop the price up so that those innovators, you know they have the market, instead of now it's 20, now it's 70, now it's 150, now it's 30.
Yeah, there people say that, and I think in the United States that's going to be a very tough political argument. But by and large, throughout history, mankind has sought cheaper energy. We've done the experiment. 400 years ago, energy costs were something like 70 or 80% of the total cost of people's disposable income. Now they're a few percent, and if we take it up beyond that, well, we do threaten affluence. But the reason we got it cheap was because of technological advancement, not the discovery of oil per se. That discovery was a result of the Industrial Revolution.
From Iowa City, Iowa. And Rick, hi, Rick, you're on the air with Chris Steiner.
Yeah, I was wondering if, I haven't read the book yet, but I was wondering if Chris addresses any type of redistribution of wealth at $20 a gallon. Will the haves and have-nots be the same? Will they switch, and will it grow any wider between them?
Interesting question, Rick. Thank you very much for it. Chris Steiner, haves, have-nots, the social structure at $20 a gallon or even halfway there?
I have to say I don't address that directly. I do think that there will always be a stratification, hopefully one that narrows, because over the last 30 years it's been nothing but widening. But I do think in some ways the rich will have an edge in that, say, they'll still be able to fly whenever they want, whereas most people won't. But I think we've seen that before. We saw that in the 70s. We saw that throughout most of the 80s. And to some degree, we see that today. But I do think technology is going to enable people to live very comfortable lives in the future. where the price of gas is $4 a gallon or $10 a gallon.
But I still wonder, I mean, you paint this picture that's quite lovely. You know, we step up, we deal with it, we respond to high energy, and we live in a world of high-speed trains and clustered housing and heirloom tomatoes grown around the corner. But what gets us on that path? Instead of, I come back to the dystopic concern, you know, is it people who can't afford all that stuff camping out in abandoned suburban McMansions, you know, 30 families to a house?
So what are you asking? What gets us on that path?
Yeah. How do you, what gives you the confidence that it's this bright path? And, you know, may it be, bring it on. I'm for the bright path, but is there some crucial fork in the road that takes us there instead of, presumably there's a lot of pain in the gear shifts along the way here. And as our caller Rick, suggests, he's concerned that not everybody's going to end up on the sort of happy side of this equation.
Well, I think, you know, if we have a slow enough increase in the price, we're going to make a rather smooth adaptation. Will there be pain? Absolutely. People who are driving 50 miles to work every day and they haven't moved and we get to $5 or $6 a gallon, that will be painful. Absolutely. But I also think that price, especially for America, is the ultimate lever of change. And government is a wild card here. You know, whether or not they institute tolling, whether or not they put on an additional gas tax is something that's long overdue. We haven't raised the federal gas tax since the early 1990s. The government could make this a smoother transition. Will they? I don't know, because messing with the gas price in any way is politically a cyanide pill for a lot of politicians. So I can't say what's going to happen there. But I do think that price itself is the lever for change.
The price driving everything. Bogdan in Hartford, Connecticut, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Okay. What do you think?
I think we're going to get there sooner than later. I think we're going to catch up with Europe. And basically, me in my current field, I'm a visiting nurse. I do around 200 to 300 miles a week.
Okay.
And I'll be going back to working at a hospital or some healthcare facility within a quarter mile of where I live. Another instance is my parents, who are looking to move out of this little suburban town they live in, Connecticut, and go up somewhere north where they could buy land to grow their own produce, because they're expecting, yes, we will have a period of a few years where, you know, the tomatoes will be much more expensive because of the shipping fees.
But will they be able to afford to drive up and harvest those tomatoes, or are they going to live up by their garden in the country?
Exactly. They will be living up there. I mean, they're at the age where they're not going to be working much longer as far as for income, driving to work. So they get to maybe retire a little bit earlier and go do what they want to do, and that will allow them to kind of save money or survive in that fashion. As far as us catching up to Europe, it's going to happen, but the infrastructure is not here, so it's going to be a tricky and a very pivotal time where a lot of people are going to be, I think, in serious jeopardy.
Bogdan, thanks for your call. Chris Steiner, a little survivalist interlude, or, you know, happy camping in the north growing tomatoes?
I think that sounds like a very nice life. I don't think they have to do that in order, you know, I don't think things are going to be that bad. In fact, I think a lot of retirees, people Tom's parents' age, are actually doing the reverse. And I think that trend, moving from the outer suburbs to, you know, people with empty nests, moving back to urban areas, places where they can walk, I see that all the time in Chicago. In fact, I see it in New York, too, from people I know. Boomers who are moving out of very suburban areas into more urban walkable areas. And I think the boomers are kind of fueling the trend right now from outer suburbia to inner suburbs and inner cities. I think that trend will continue, not only because of the boomers, but because of gas prices.
Do you literally see outer suburbia lined with houses standing empty? Will somebody be able to, you know, will new industry grow up out there so people can live there, or is it just too long a drive at $6, $8, $10 a gallon gas?
I would be worried about some of the very furthest exurbs, especially the ones that aren't making changes now to bring some kind of economic gravity to their towns. The Metropolitan Institute at Virginia Tech University estimates that by 2025, America will have an excess of 23 million large lot homes. That doesn't mean nobody will be in those homes, but it does mean that not many people are going to want them.
Wow. What is that? wait, nobody will be in them, but people won't want, I mean, if people don't want them, maybe they're barns.
Well, they're not worth very much money, and so maybe they are barns. And I think you're going to see an erasure of equity on some levels in some of these places. And I think we have seen that before when you talk about the inner cities of St. Louis, Detroit, Cleveland, Pittsburgh over the last 50 years, places that have lost 50% of their population. I think those places will get that population back. I think those places have very bright futures.
Because they're dense, because you don't have to drive so far. Erasure of equity, there's a phrase to turn over in your mind. Curtis, in Burlington, Vermont, you're on the air with Chris Steiner. Curtis?
Hi, Tom. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
I think Chris's points were excellent. I'd be interested in Chris's perspective on energy efficiency, renewable energy, wind, solar, biomass specifically. This conversation hasn't focused on that, but let me just make one comment about that authors who called in focus on billions of dollars of cleaning up coal. I mean, we have just scratched the surface in terms of the renewable energy efficiency technologies. We're not going to be hopefully investing billions of dollars into those technologies when we could be building massive wind farms in the Midwest and solar farms in the Southwest as well, all across the country. And it's going to create jobs. The wind industry is larger industry than the coal industry now. I mean, these are important concepts. I just wanted to make sure that we focus the conversation.
Curtis, I'm glad you raised them, but do you think that renewable energy, wind, solar, biomass, will let us dodge this bullet of, you know, $10 gas or $20 gas somehow? Curtis, first to you, then I'll come to you, Chris Steiner. Curtis, is that your...
I get to go first. There you go. I think that the key is that these technologies are going to come online as the price goes up, and we're going to see competition between what we're seeing now, competition between renewables and oil today. As oil has less supply, wind and solar are going to beat out oil, and you're going to probably see the declining price of oil because these technologies are clean. They're going to meet up with the climate crisis that we have. I think they hold lots of opportunity. They're not going to solve every problem, like Chris has pointed out, and I agree with him, but it's going to make a dramatic difference.
That would be nice. Curtis, thanks for calling. There's the whale oil scenario, Chris Steiner, where renewables step in and, you know, hold energy prices down or much cleaner, save the day. What do you say?
I think that I'm all for renewable energy. I think wind especially is going to play a very large role in our energy future. But I do think that wind and solar are competing primarily with coal. They're not competing with oil. You don't put wind and solar in your tanks. You don't put wind and solar into your desktops, your ceiling panels, your paint, your carpet.
Let's separate those two. First, on the tank, with electric cars, you can put wind in your tank, can't you, with solar?
You can, but as we know, wind faces a number of capricious issues in that it doesn't always blow, and solar, of course, it's not on at night. So, and it tends to blow hard in places very far from where we live. I mean, these are cliched problems, but they're very true problems. We have to figure out ways to use wind power best that don't include building giant transmission lines from North Dakota to Chicago, where we lose 30% of the electricity.
Now, what about, you begin to mention there, the built environment side of this, if I can use that word. You've got a fictional character, Bill, in your book, who wakes up in the morning and practically everything he touches in the first 30 minutes of his life is made from an oil-based product. What about the built environment and the changes you see there, the things around us, Chris?
Well, we use oil to make everything. And Bill, in the book, he's a pretty typical American. He's walking, eating, washing with, driving on oil. And I think that kind of the physicality of oil, people don't realize how many products it's really in and how it enables the world we live in. But I do think that some of those things will go away, and we'll just use less of it. And we're already doing that in some ways. But it's amazing at how some things made with oil persevere. You talk about a wiffle ball bat, that'll probably be around longer than your house.
But it won't be bright and shiny for Christmas. I mean, you're looking at basically everything we touch, the carpet and the toothbrush and the clock radio and the, you know, even the shampoo he's using and right on, I mean, just about everything. Are we going to be carving toothbrushes from wood, or what do you see coming?
I think we'll recycle more. I think at some point, you know, whether it's $200 barrel oil or $250 or $175 barrel oil, it becomes much more economical, it makes much more sense in an economic way to recycle, to reuse the hydrocarbons we have. Right now, it's just cheaper to pull new ones out of the ground and reform them. But at some point, you're going to reach a hurdle point at which we use more of the stuff we have around already. And I think that will increase the value of existing stuff. And I think existing stuff will also get repaired more readily than just thrown out.
Honey, tape my broken toothbrush, or I will. Denise in Nashville, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
How are you?
Pretty good. What do you think, Denise?
Well, I was actually responding to the gas prices. There was somebody who was saying that he didn't think that people can really adapt because they live too far away from where they work. I've been without a car for 5 years, and it can, and I've seen last summer when gas prices went up, a lot of people were starting to buy bicycles.
Yeah. How long is your commute, Denise? How far do you ride every day if you do?
Well, I actually work about 4 miles away from where I live.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the trick is to never look for a job you can't get to.
Right,
you know?
Right. So it's doable, but you have had to build your life around it. I mean, that's a change. It's not, fine, I can commute 50 miles.
Right, exactly. And I think it can be done, but our total structure of the country would change drastically, obviously.
You've done it yourself, Denise. Do you think Americans will freak out making this change, or they'll like it, even love it, or what?
I think ultimately they could grow to love it, because you begin to see the world totally different for one reason, because you're out in the world all the time, you know, walking or mm-hmm. biking or whatever. But you also can see that it's possible that the whole structure would change, because you can't work 60 miles away from where you live, like what you were saying.
And you're already on top of it, and I guess it sounds like you're happy with it, Denise.
You know, I mean, I would like to own a vehicle, but when I think about the expense, it just wears me out. And that's the only reason why I gave it up.
You'd you know? Have it if you could afford it. In the meantime, it's 4 miles on the bike, and it's working.
I mean, I could afford it. It's just that I don't need to.
Right, right.
You know, I just decided I'm from the Boston area originally, which has the best subway system in the country, and the original subway system in the country. And here in Nashville, the public transportation is really not very good at all.
So you're on your bike. Denise, our time grows short here. I appreciate your call very much, and happy, safe biking there. Christina, your epilogue is a kind of one big mural of how life will look different on the other side of this change. I wish you kind of paint that picture for us. You've got your bill. He's living along. Energy prices are much higher. He's in a changed world. It's a world he likes in your envisioning. Paint the picture for us, Chris.
Well, I think what Denise was saying about don't look for a job you can't get to, I think that will become reality very soon for a lot of people. Right now, people don't put geographical limits within their metro areas on a job. People don't think twice about driving 50 miles to go to work.
Mm-hmm.
And because they might want that 3,000 square foot house that they can afford way out in the middle of nowhere. Well, in the future, that's not the way things are going to be. People are going to live more urbanly. They're going to live walkable lives. We will have a high-speed train network, especially in the Midwest and the East Coast and the West Coast. And eventually, I think those will be connected. But in generally, I think there will be a lot more people in the next couple of generations growing up without cars, growing up without making 8-mile trips to school and 8-mile trips to the grocery store as a normal part of their lives. I think there'll be a whole new generation of Americans, perhaps two generations from now, that will have grown up completely without cars instead of having 3 in their family or 2 in their family. I think we're closer to that reality than people realize.
You said grandchildren will listen to tales of flying to Disney World with amazement in their eyes. Are Americans going to like that?
Well, certainly people will not be happy about changes like that, but I think Disney's not going to go away. DVDs and everything else they do certainly has a great future. But, yeah, I think some of the things that we're used to now and been used to over the last 20, 30 years, I think our grandkids will marvel at some of those stories. But sometimes I think they'll also think they're very silly.
You know, we've just got a few more seconds. You must have started this, though, before the economic crash of a year ago. Does all this work with the economy in the dumps, or does the economy somehow have to be humming to make the happy changes you describe happen?
Well, nothing works with the economy in the dumps, does it? I think that to see demand go up to a point where we see $4 or $5 gas, certainly the economy has to get better, and it will get better. But gas prices will force us at some point into mini recessions. As you know, as we get to, say, $5 or $6 per gallon, we'll see demand destruction at those levels. But technology and new ways of life will come online, and people will change their lives so that we will be able to continue growing economically with higher oil prices.
Christopher Steiner, his new book is $20 per Gallon, How the Inevitable Rise in the Price of Gasoline Will Change Our Lives for the Better. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.